Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the Saleri Report, the Saker. We're so excited. He's agreed to come on quarterly for the year, and we're going to talk each time about the shift from the unipolar to multipolar world. I can't tell you how excited I am that we're doing this. Our first conversation several months ago was a huge success. So, Saker, welcome back to the Saleri Report.
Thank you very, very much. It's a very real pleasure.
Well, after we did our last interview, one of our most astute subscribers came and he said, you know, I have to confess, I really don't understand what it means to go from a unipolar to a multipolar world. He said, you know, I accept, you know, it makes sense that that's true. So I believe it's true, but I'm so stuck in a unipolar world, I don't really even understand what it means. So could you get Saker to go back and maybe explain this from scratch? Can we get a 101 on unipolar to multipolar world?
That sounds very good. Well, I guess the first thing that comes to mind for me is the word compromise. And that directly entails the importance of diplomacy. I think that's the most important aspect of that. In a unipolar world, you have one entity setting the rules and enforcing them. So that's what we see today. For instance, think of U.S. State Department, which really should be called something like the U.S. Department of Orders and Ultimatums or something like that. there is really no diplomacy taking place. I mean, right. The empire says this is how it shall be. And then you either accept it and you get the protection of the empire, or you don't. And in that case, you are labeled a rogue state, a supporter of terrorism, or a dictatorship at the very least. And I think the very clear manifestation of that is the contrast between Russian and U.S. diplomacy. We have seen that Russian diplomacy at work in the Ukraine and in Syria specifically. And in both cases, the other day I was listening to Professor Stephen Cohen, whom I consider probably the foremost authority on Soviet and Russian affairs in the U.S. And he mentioned something very interesting. He said that during both campaigns in the Ukraine, Vladimir Putin clearly ordered a stop to the hostilities before, and a situation where the rebels could clearly maximize and go much further, particularly take the city of Mariupol, which were very much in their hands. And now we see the same thing happening in Syria, where the Russians essentially offered negotiations at a moment where they were at the brink of reaching the Syrian border, completely liberating Aleppo. And the Russia, it could, if you think in terms of unipolar world, that makes no sense. I mean, there you are at the edge of a military victory and suddenly you're stopping. That made absolutely no sense. And in multipolar worlds, the logic is very different. You stop there because you've created the conditions for compromise and negotiations.
Right.
And the reason why negotiations are preferable, because you would think, well, why should I negotiate if I can have it all? Is because the have it all, i.e. the purely military solution, is temporarily very, very pleasant and rewarding, but it's not stable in the long term. Whereas a negotiated solution is much more stable in the long term. So one of the characteristics of that, I would say, would be that negotiations and the role of diplomacy becomes number one. In a unipolar world, diplomacy is done mainly by aircraft carriers, and diplomats have a supportive role. They are there to deliver messages and to negotiate surrenders. In a multipolar world, the function is crucial, and the supportive role is played by the military. When the conditions are not there for a negotiation, then the military is used, but only to the point and up to the moment where the conditions are created again, and then the diplomats take center stage. And we saw that with Minsk 1, which was the result of the first Ukrainian defeat, Minsk 2, which was the result of the second Ukrainian defeat, and now the negotiation in Syria, which is are the result of the defeat of Daesh in Syria. And all three cases, in purely military terms, the Russians could have easily pushed forward. and they did not do that. So I think that is one of the most compelling differences between how a multipolar versus a unipolar world would function. The second thing, in a unipolar world, you have you don't have allies. You have hegemon and vassal states who basically have to agree and support and share the decisions of the emperor. Again, in a way of functioning of the multipolar world, I don't know if you're aware of that, but President Rouhani of Iran clearly stated in an interview recently that Russia and I and we have different views on Syria and different objectives. It's very interesting because these two are fundamental allies, but both sides recognize that they have different priorities. So that's, again, the outputs of their collaboration will be a compromise between what each party wants. But it's in no way weakens, if you want, the resolve of what I call the informal resistance alliance, which is Russia, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah. The fact that all of them have different views in no way weakens their effectiveness because they negotiate until they come to an agreement and then they act towards their common objective, but yet they keep their complete sovereignty and their own opinion. I can multiply examples of that.
Right. It's very interesting. Whenever I work with someone from different Europeans, so I'll hone in on the Swiss or the Dutch. Both are very small countries, and the citizens speak generally more than one language. So they're used to dealing with multiple languages, and they pride themselves on understanding and dealing effectively with many different cultures. They're very outward looking in terms of, you know, they take responsibility to understand different areas of the world and understand different people. I used to live in Hong Kong, and I far preferred it because in Hong Kong you'd wake up and the news was about every place in the world. Whereas in the United States, you'd wake up and the news was about the United States, and, you know, there was a tiny amount about the rest of the world. And so they were much more knowledgeable and sophisticated about the world. Whereas, you know, coming out of a unipolar world, you were really sheltered in your little unipolar bubble. And it's funny. When you go to a website to buy a product and you have to click on what country you're from and it's a website that sells globally, now if you're from the United States, you have to move the cursor all the way down to the United States. 10 years ago, it would automatically pop up the United States.
Yeah, I noticed that. But in all fairness, first of all, the United States, I mean, it's isolated by two huge oceans. And the internet being a U.S. invention, I mean, I think the list of countries 10 years ago that would have been under the United States would have been pretty short. Whereas now, you know, they have it in Nepal and they have it in the remotest parts of South America or Africa.
Well, and part of it is, you know, we're a small part of the market now. I'm not saying, you know, tiny, but if you look at the growth that's happening around the world and in Asia, you know, we are no longer the number one user of the internet at all. So
I didn't know that.
There's a great piece in The Economist called The Great Race about all the firms running to get Asia or to get India, because India is right now, China's the largest internet market, but India is expected to go beyond them. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. So the gold rush is on and over in New Delhi. Another thing about the multipolar world that I think of is also if you have the United States playing the cop, particularly with respect to the sea lanes, you know, or sort of different transportation and trade issues, when you go to a multipolar world, then you run the risk of having to negotiate with multiple toll booths. You know, in a unipolar world, if you want to operate globally, you just have to basically negotiate with one guy. In a multipolar world, you have to negotiate with many.
Yes, but I will also say that keeping the sea lines of communications open, were they ever threatened? I mean, right now the U.S. is seriously saying that China is threatening the sea lines of communications, which China completely depends on. So in reality,
right.
I think it's a complete fallacy. The only purpose really is to be able to close them if and when they want, and also to project power. I mean, that SWAC,
right.
the sea line of communication protection, I think it's a complete scam. I don't buy it for 1 second.
Well,
I don't
recall where I buy
anybody
it.
Ever trying to close it.
Here's where I buy it. If you're running a U.S. company and you're in a unipolar world, then, I always tell this story. When I was at Dillon Reed, the chairman used to walk into the strategic planning meeting at the beginning of the year and say, let me tell you what's going to happen this year. And as long as you played ball, you kind of knew what, you had the intelligence and you were given heads up and you had certainty in a way. In a multipolar world, now what we're seeing is U.S. companies and investors getting surprised again and again. It's, commodities plummet and keep plummeting and they don't know and they're surprised. So you don't have this, you're not operating in this sort of information bubble where you're taken care of and you're in a much more complex, volatile, dynamic environment. And so I think for a company that used to operate under the unipolar umbrella, you're now in a very different operating world and you're scared because your whole organization has to learn how to rock and roll, and that's not how it's been set up or evolved.
No, I understand that, but that I would think of that more of as intelligence support than keeping the sea lines of communications open. I mean, that's the
right.
What I was referring to is the mission of the Navy to keep those lines open. I don't recall them ever being threatened. I mean, piracy in off the coast of Somalia, et cetera, was internationally organized and tolerated. And the Strait of Hormuz, the Iranians didn't close it, and if they wanted to, they actually could. So,
right.
again, I don't recall in Far East Asia, besides minor piracy issues, I mean, certainly no country such as China or any other local country has ever threatened to close the sea lines of communications.
Right.
I even wonder what the latest historical precedent would it be: World War II and the U.S. cutting off Japan from oil supplies. I mean,
right.
That would be the one that I can think of.
Okay, so I constantly get asked what's going on in Syria, and I consistently answer, I have no idea. It has literally, from my vantage point, become impossible to kind of discern what's really happening. So, Syria, what's happening?
Well, first of all, I would preface this by saying it's still extremely unstable. Basically, the Russians have achieved their objectives, which were always clearly announced. They were always limited. And keep in mind, and this is absolutely crucial because it's always overlooked, is that the Russian force in Syria was always very small.
Right.
You can think of it as 50 aircraft, basically. Now, Saudi Arabia and Turkey combined would be able to muster roughly 500 combat aircraft. So think of it as a 10 to 1. The Russian objectives were extremely limited. The first objective was to stabilize the Syrian government, basically to protect them from being overrun and to protect Damascus from being taken over by Daesh. That objective has been achieved. The second objective of the Russians was to create the conditions for negotiations. That objective has been achieved. So it's very limited objective. There never was a plan to, protect Syria from NATO, never. Protect Syria from Turkey, never. Protect Hezbollah from Israel, never was part of the plan. To single-handedly win the war, that all these, people were predicting a huge intervention, and, none of that ever was a reality. The Russians used a very limited contingent. They used them extremely effectively, that's true. And they achieved superb results because what they did basically is they went in three phases. First, they basically destroyed the infrastructure on an operational level supporting Daesh. Then they went into close air support and began providing firepower to the Syrians because they lack that very much. The Syrians have been at war longer now against Daesh than the Russians have been involved in World War II. This has been a long war. So their equipment was worn, their forces were decimated, and they had lost many people. So the Russians, while providing firepower in a close air support mission, at the same time were frantically busy rearming, training, and supporting the Syrian military until it became capable of, again, offensive combat operations, which it has. And at that moment in time, Putin essentially stopped it all, as he had actually said he would, and basically created the conditions for negotiations. Now, one of the things that she's not said, but which is really important, is that, I don't know if you noticed, the Russians were saying there's no such thing as a Syrian free army. They were saying they're essentially sitting in Istanbul or in London, but they don't exist on the ground. And now the Russians are saying we're negotiating with the Syrian free army. So what's happening here? Well, it's very simple. The Russians have extensive experience of that phenomenon in Afghanistan. What is today the Free Syrian Army is mostly composed of small groups who change sides simply. They're former allies of Daesh who now rebranded themselves from bad terrorists into good freedom fighters in order not to be bombed and destroyed and in order to be part of the of political solution. So what really the Russians did, they gave an incentive to a whole lot of Syrians who were opposed to the central government to break away from the real crazy, the liver-eating crazies of Daesh, and to join a political dialogue by rebranding themselves. And what's happening right now is... Go ahead.
Explain who Daesh is.
Daesh is basically what's ISIS, if you want, you can say that. It's I call them all Daesh on principle because there are thin, minor differences between Al-Qaeda, Jaish al-Islam, al-Nusra, etc. But really, we're talking about hardcore Wahhabi terrorists who absolutely hate pretty much everybody who's not agrees to their brand of Islam. So they're, you know, viciously anti-Shia, of course, but they're also anti-Sunni if the Sunni doesn't believe like they do. They're anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, anti-everybody. They want to create, their plan is to create a state, a caliphate, which would live according to the religious edicts of 18th century Saudi Arabia, basically. These are the guys who, you know, decapitate online, slit throats, burn people alive. I mean, all the horrors that you saw. It's basically one, I would say, a confederation of Wahhabi crazies. And I think...
What's the difference between them and just a version of mercenaries?
Mercenaries, in my book, act primarily for money.
Right.
There, I think there is a mix. These extremist groups in Afghanistan, they were linked to drug deals. In Chechnya, they were very heavily involved in illegal petroleum exports. Of course, there's a strong element of mobsters. Because there's nothing as good for a mobster, a common thug, as to brand himself as a combatant for the pure faith.
Right.
But still, their core ideology, their appeal to people, and the reason why people go and blow themselves up, which a mercenary is not going to do, is a sincere, if frightening, belief in a basically very simple, extraordinarily simplified, and I would say distorted version of Islam.
Right. Right. So now that... Putin is saying the Russians have accomplished what they set out to do and they're leaving. Where will that leave things?
Well, first of all, they're not leaving. They are kind of sort of leaving, which is they've withdrawn most of their close air support and strike aircraft, not all, specifically the Su-25, Su-24s, and some part of the Sukhoi 34s, which is the brand new aircraft. But they have left, the air defense structure has been unaffected. The S-400s are still there. The closer range Panzer systems are still there. The Russian Navy is still in the port of Tartus. There are, I think officially, eight interceptors. I think four Sukhois 30SM and four Su-35s still left over, but I think this group is going to be reinforced. So basically, they have left the infrastructure needed to control the airspace over Syria, prevent an attack on the Russians, and prevent the West from establishing a no-fly zone. And they still very much can come back. I mean, literally, for instance, the more advanced aircraft that they have is the Sukhoi 34, could conduct strikes from Russia, from southern Russia, as could their strategic bombers, as could their submarines. So the big difference is they're not providing right now what's called close air support, where you help a Syrian unit, you know, fighting for a specific town. They would come in and bomb right in front of them. That's what would be called close air support. They've stopped doing that. But they stopped doing that anyways because they're basically because of that negotiation. They've right. dramatically reduced the number of sorties anyway. So at that point, they say, let's do a gesture of goodwill and withdraw a very visible part of our contingent there. But the special forces are still there. And the airport is still functioning. So for them, it's literally the flight time needed to get there. Putin officially said that. He said, we can be back in a matter of hours.
Right, but what it looks like to me is the U.S. had taken the position they wanted Assad gone, and the Russians have prevented that, and the U.S. has stood down. Is that
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the U.S. has stood down. I don't think that the forces inside the U.S. who are lobbying for a removal of Assad, which is the neocon, the Israel lobby, and the Saudi lobby, are going to accept that. So I don't believe that the fact that the Americans are going to play an honest role in this. I think they'll try to subvert it. The Turks are right now in a very serious situation, and there still is a risk of a Turkish and Saudi invasion. And I would add, by the way, removing some of the Russian aircraft from the Khmeimim air base, which is very close to Turkey, also would make military sense. So that could be read as a preparation for a possible Turkish move in, and then the Russians would be better off striking from a longer distance. And it is also a way of making it harder for the Turks to invade, because right now, since the buzzword is peace and negotiations, it would make the Turks look terrible if they now invaded Syria. So I think these were all considerations of that I would call redeployment and change of strategy. Right now, there are hopes, I think they're real, if the U.S. is willing to not disrupt and not push towards resumption of full-scale hostility for some kind of negotiated solution, which would basically unite. That's another thing. The assumption was made that first you have to defeat Daesh and then you fix and reform Syria. I think it's the other way around. First you fix Syria, because I mean, there's no doubt that the Assad regime was unpopular and Syria needs reform, and even the Russians said that from day one. I think they're trying to do that now. They're trying to get a negotiation going where most of the forces in Syria would participate in some kind of joint government of national salvation of some kind and unite against Daesh and then free their country. I think that is the plan. Will it work? I think it's way too early to call. It's a very daring plan to try to achieve peace first and then, you know, solve the military problem, which is very hard to solve anyways. The Turks are going nowhere, right. And the Saudis are going nowhere, and these are the prime sponsors of this entire civil war. So it's going to take a long while, even if they're successful.
Well, let's step back to the Saudis and Israel and go back to the Iran deal. Why did we reach an agreement with Iran? We see tremendous controversy here about whether or not this deal made sense. So why did we make the deal, and what do you think?
Well, I have to admit here that I have been always fearing, and I always thought that there would be a U.S. attack on Iran. Therefore, I was surprised by that deal. I have to confess that. And what I will say is that this never was about nuclear weapons. I don't think Iran ever had much of a nuclear weapon program. Might have some research, but never tried to develop anything. I think the Iranians don't need it. I think they know that. I do take their leader seriously, who says that this is an un-Islamic and it's a banned kind of warfare. I think it's all about submitting Iran and not letting Iran get away with murder, murder being defined as openly defying the U.S. and Israel. First of all, that's one definition of political murder. The second one is you cannot allow Iran to be a successful and prosperous country. And having a peaceful nuclear program is one of the markers which says, you know, we're a developed, peaceful, developed country. Because the image that the empire wants of Muslim countries is backward, you know, head chopping, torturing, you know, basically totally barbarians. And here you have a country who has a large young population, well-educated, which managed to develop in spite of sanctions, which is, has an extremely sophisticated foreign policy, very advanced elites. That country is not allowed to succeed, but because that itself is a weakening of the empire. So I think that was the real stake. And now why was an agreement reached? My only explanation is that imperial overreach, that literally the call was made, we don't have what it takes to pursue this.
Right.
We have to try to achieve by negotiations what we couldn't by bullying, because Iran is too influential, too powerful. We need to talk to these guys. We need to try to find some kind of modus vivendi with such a huge regional power. I think that is what explains that.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I just interviewed Don Cox, who's an investment advisor, who was insistent that this means Iran is going to have the weapon, nuclear weapons, in a relatively short order, a couple of years, and the Saudis and the Israel oppose that because what they realize is it means everybody's going to, you're going to have a nuclear race going on in the Middle East, and so it really comes down to what the assessment is of their. Of their ability to build a nuclear weapon.
See, I don't buy that argument. I'll tell you why. Is that I don't believe nuclear weapons play that kind of role at all. I mean, Iran, a nuclear weapon can be useful for a small country fearing invasion, but Iran is a big country that has no that is uninvadable. The proof that Iran is strong enough is the fact that Iran never got invaded during all these years of severe tensions.
Right.
And that in itself proves to me that there was no need for them to have a nuclear weapon to add to deterrence. And actually the opposite, I would say. The nuclear weapon paints, having a few nuclear devices paints a bullseye on you, and if you ever use them, you're submitting yourself to legitimate and very strong retaliation. Like Saddam Hussein never could use his chemicals because the U.S. has told them unequivocally, if you use chemical weapons on us, we will retaliate. So I don't believe Iran ever had a I think this is a complete canard about Iran needing or wanting a nuclear weapon program. And I'll see in the future. Maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I don't think they'll ever, not for the foreseeable future. No, I don't think they'll develop one.
One of my theories is that that the Americans use nuclear weapon, or the international community uses international nuclear weapons, when in fact what they're worried about is a different kind of weapon than a nuclear weapon. But since that weapon is not something in the public understanding, they just use nuclear weapon. In other words, So they're afraid of technology other than nuclear weapon, but that technology is something invisible or the population doesn't understand or they don't want to bring up, it's classified, and so they just use nuclear weapon, even though it's a complete lie.
You think of a military technology or you think economics here?
I tend to think that the big problem here is exactly what you said. They don't want Iran having energy independence through nuclear technology and being a developed country without the G7 giving them permission to do so.
Exactly.
So it's the economic model and its defiance. But I also, it wouldn't surprise me if the Iranians have a kind of technology that is either weaponized or could be weaponized that is other than nuclear weapons, and they... That concerns them, because if they can develop and have that technology, then they're really not under anybody's thumb. And the problem is not that they're not under anybody's thumb, but it means everybody else is going to get ideas.
Well, I think that's what we see happening today, coming back to our issue of a multipolar world, is right. that what you're saying about Iran is already happening. I mean, they're having a host of, I wouldn't call them minor technologies, but not as visible technologies as nuclear weapons, but they, you know, they're excelling in electronic warfare, they're excelling in small ships, coastal defense, air defense systems, missiles. But the same is true for China, the same is true for Russia. I mean, what's happening today is that countries are gradually developing sufficient protection means to not be under anybody's thumb, and then they go for, of course, energy and economic independence. So I agree right. with you completely. It's already happening. I don't think it's a secret technology, you know, some kind of weapon that any of those countries would have that is not spoken about. I think it's the sum of being, Iran is a perfect example. It's a big country. I mean, it's hard to invade. Big population, big country, with enough technology to defend itself, right. to give a very good defense. And right. that the combination of that with politics makes it basically unattackable.
Right.
And, of course, China and Russia being completely unattackable at that point because they have everything.
And China just built a train that goes all the way from China into Iran. So.
Oh, I was not aware of that. I knew they wanted to build one going from China to essentially to Europe.
Oh, about Russia. 30 days ago. It's up on our website. Yeah. The first train went through, I think it was a, trying to remember the exact date. So it went all the way from China into Iran and basically saved, you know, if you look at how long it took for the train to go, it saved 31 days on the transport time if you had instead mm-hmm. gone by ship.
Hmm. So yeah, that's very much what's going to happen. Yeah. There is, first of all the land routes east-west over the Eurasian landmass. And then secondly, the Russians are very, very intensively working on the sea routes going along the northern border of Russia, global warming helping with that. They're creating the infrastructure to create a major shipping lane
right.
going through the Arctic Sea.
Right.
And that's also going to cut time by a lot.
Right. So if you look at the build out on the Silk Road, it's explosive in terms of wealth creation. It's amazing
yes.
what's going to happen. Yeah. And that's why I think the China-Iran connection has always been one that's freaked the United States out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's, I wanted to mention one thing. I just published a book review on David Talbot's book about Alan Dulles. It's called The Devil's Chessboard. And it's fascinating because one of the things you realize is the Anglo-American alliance spent World War I and World War II and made enormous sacrifices to basically amass a huge amount of global power. And then John F. Kennedy comes in and essentially decides he's going to switch everything to a multipolar world. And I realized, oh, that was the empire's last experiment with stopping a multipolar world from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see from the time of the Kennedy assassination, this real build out of a unipolar world, and you take it global with the balancing of the global economy. And now you have, you really have a kind of exhaustion and unraveling. It's almost like they tried to do a global empire and it didn't quite make it. And now it's unraveling back. And
mm-hmm.
and whereas Kennedy was trying to do it the nice way, now we're going to do it the rough way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it wasn't. I never thought of Kennedy as trying to unravel the empire. To be honest, I would need to think about that. But what is certainly happening is that there's imperial overreach, very evidently happening. Yes.
Right. Right. So now,
and it shows in a collapse of power and authority, and particularly in very unhealthy relationships. I mean, the fact that the U.S. had to beat down Europe into submission over policies which are clearly detrimental to Europe very much goes to show that that's a sign of weakness, of imperial overreach. It's not an alliance
right.
anymore. It's literally, you know, a colonial states who have to obey any order given to them.
Right. So let's turn to Europe because Europe is We have, I was just reading the latest reports on what's happening in the UK. So we have the UK referendum on the continued role in the European Union in June. And we clearly see Europe struggling with immigration. And the question is, will the European Union hold together?
You're asking for a prediction?
Mm-hmm.
No, not in its current form, no. And I'm not sure the referendum, you know, a referendum can be hijacked, has been done in the past. And the other old trick that they
right.
use is if they don't get the right answer to the referendum, they just repeat
they
the
just
referendum.
They just have another.
They get the right answer. Yeah.
Right.
I think what Europe needs is regime change. And by regime, I don't mean negatively. I make a difference between, you know, a government and a regime. A regime is a system of government versus the actual
right.
people in power. I think the EU, the way it was designed, you know, the U.S. Bilderberger view of United Europe, as opposed to that, the one of de Gaulle, who saw more of a Europe of fatherlands, as he called it, I think is dying right now. And it's not sustainable, and it alienates more and more people in Europe. So I think there's going to be a major crisis in Europe resulting from, you know, immigration certainly, economy certainly is going to happen. The black hole of the Ukraine will cost Europe a lot in political and economic terms. You saw that.
How do you think so? How will that play out?
Well, because you have a country which is huge, which has, you know, 40 million people, who essentially is turning into Somalia right now, and somebody will have
right.
to pay. It is absolutely ridiculous to think that Russia can foot the bill for that. Russia, you know, it's a big country, but it's a relatively small economy. Russia can barely help the Donbass economically. Russia does not have the means to resurrect and pump up normal conditions in the Ukraine. This country has been absolutely, thoroughly destroyed.
Right.
There's still some inertia left, which, you know, doesn't, and there's a lot of very good obfuscation happening, but the reality is that the Ukraine is finished as a country, completely. Economically, it's gone. Socially, I would say it's gone. Politically, I would say it's gone. I mean, what's left is territory and people, armed and hungry. And everybody will have to pay for that. I mean, Russia will have to pitch in, but so will the U.S. and so will Europe primarily. Because Russia will be able to keep their borders closed if need be. Russia has that ability. That's a crucial advantage that Russia has over Europe. Russia, if needed, can shut down her borders. Europe can do that. And the Europeans will have to pay most of that bill, which is only fair considering the role they played in the destruction of the Ukraine. You know, there is what I call karmic justice happening here again.
Right.
But that will be expensive. And you saw that attack today on Brussels. You know, that's scary stuff, and that's the future of Europe. It's going to get very, very ugly, and I think that the political elites who are running Europe right now are both incapable, incompetent, and unwilling, particularly, to address it in any effective way. Right now, there is no politicians who are thinking of defending Europe, and that will have to change. What will have to happen in... It's same as the Ukraine, by the way. Nobody in the Ukraine, in the elites, cares about this country. So what will happen eventually and inevitably is that you'll have to have a regime in power in Kyiv who actually for the first time cares about the Ukraine. And in Europe, you'll have to have regimes who actually care about the European people. And until that happens, the crisis is going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. I mean, I really am extremely pessimistic for the future of Europe.
So in the European Union, do you think there's a chance it'll pull back into the northern European countries?
We can't do that on political grounds. That's too late.
Okay.
The elites are so invested. You have to understand that all the elites there are hardcore Atlanticists. They're completely invested in that specific model of development of Europe. They're completely invested in that crazy move to extend Europe to Eastern, Central and Eastern Europe, and even some are discussing beyond. I mean, it's that political rhetoric, they're all invested 100% to it, and they cannot
Well, part of it is now that they've organized into the euro, you know, all of their systems, their financial systems are organized into it. So, you know, if you had kept your individual, you know, so if you're Switzerland or Norway or the UK, it's not as ugly a transition to break out. But if you're wholly dependent on the euro, it's a whole nother ball game.
Yeah. So it's going to be very painful. It was an it's a good idea, actually, but totally manipulated and redirected towards the welfare of the people of Europe was never part of that. And so only new politicians, a new generation that are not, you know, personally, their credibility does not stand on the success of that project, can do something. And they're right now, they're nowhere near the circle of the power right now in Europe. Nowhere, right. Nowhere near.
Okay, so let's turn to the U.S. presidential campaign.
Okay.
Because in November, I suddenly got, I don't, you know, I'm kind of a person who doesn't scare very easily, but I really got scared that global investors would take a look at the United States and say, you know, this place is not under adult supervision, and it's done nothing but get crazier ever since. So I'm very curious as to what you think the global response to the U.S. presidential campaign is, and I'd also love to know what you think the global response will be to either one of what is now the leading nominees on the Democratic and Republican side?
Well, I have to confess to you that I only recently began paying attention to that because I don't believe at all in the current U.S. political system. To me, it is the best democracy money can buy. And it is, you know, $1, one vote, and not one person, one vote. So I view that with right. utter cynicism. You change the puppets, but you keep the puppeteers.
Right.
Now, for a while, I started looking at Trump with interest just because of the hate campaign against him. I thought, you know, maybe it's, you know, the Frankenstein or the golem. I think initially he was probably pushed by the deep state to make Hillary more palatable in comparison. And for a while, I thought maybe he's getting out of control. But I just listened this morning to his speech in front of AIPAC, and I went, okay, he's the same deal. So I don't expect a regime change in the U.S. as a result of that election, which is the only thing that would really get me interested, would be regime change. But puppet change, you know, we saw it with Obama, with change you can believe in, or all the rest of the promised read my lips.
I didn't believe a word of it.
Neither did I. I actually posted on my blog, I posted a speech from Malcolm X where he spoke about, you know, the House Negro and the Field Negro. And I asked just the question, do you think Malcolm X would call Obama a field or a House Negro? And we got the answer after that, that, you know, as are all the, most of the you know, the blacks around these administrations, they're even worse than the white people. I mean, you look at Susan Rice and all the rest of them, they're just horrible. So, to be honest, I have just one real fear is Hillary. I mean, she frightens me. I think she is incompetent and evil enough and deluded enough to actually think she can bully Russia into submission, and it's not going to happen. So that, with her, I fear a war, actually. I really do. With the others, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I don't see the elections as providing change. Relevant change. Maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe I'm wrong about Trump, and maybe he can do something, but I can't possibly take him seriously after
that. So I agree with you completely on that, although I do think, you know, whichever faction is running the machinery makes incremental differences, minor differences.
Yes, agreed. On that, I agree.
Here's my one fear. So let's talk about Clinton. Clinton came up in a unipolar world, and she's from what I can tell, she's very similar to some of the people I worked with in the Bush administration. And it's almost as though they cannot grasp complexity. Everything is conceptual. Everything is abstract. They come up with a concept and then they stamp it on. Mm-hmm. And so you go into Libya, you want the gold, you want the oil, you destroy everything. And then you have no plan as to how. You know, you take a country that's very advanced and developed, you know, where people have a very nice life, and you basically destroy everything, and you have no plan as to how that's supposed to work. You know, it's basically going around the world destroying things.
Yes, and I have to tell you, she's the one who then declared recently that we never lost didn't lose a single life in Libya.
That's after having a U.S. ambassador lynched to death. I mean, and you heard her remark about Gaddafi. We came, we saw, he died. I mean, as far as I know, her entire career is a mix of failures and taking liberties with the law of the land. I mean, she is really a scary lady. I think she's extraordinarily incompetent and just plain evil. And she's clearly, the one the neocons favor. That's why I thought, because of the name and her reputation, her negative ratings, my impression was that Trump served the function of the boogeyman that would make her more palatable. And I suppose, if you really force me to say which is the lesser evil, I suppose I would say Trump, just because the neocons seem to be so in lockstep behind Clinton. But, they don't depend on one administration. They're having their influence in both. It's like the Nazis had the SI and the SS. And I would agree that the SI were probably marginally better. But, still there's Nazis.
There was a very funny article, I think it was in the New York Times, where when Trump swept, I think it was Super Tuesday, one of the lead neocons threw a hissy fit about, why you could never tolerate Trump. And he said, he changes his position and he doesn't keep his deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
And I thought that the neocons would complain.
Yeah, about that.
You don't like dealing with yourself? What's your problem?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a scary, very, very sad and scary. I don't know. This election makes me worried. It really does.
Well,
it's just getting worse and worse.
Right, it's getting worse and worse. But I also think within the general population, you're seeing more and more frustration.
Yes.
And Leonard Cohen has a wonderful song that I love, the line says, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets through.
Mm-hmm.
And the more the establishment and various parties fight, because remember, they're not fighting over real policies. The real policies are run by the deep state. They're fighting over who will get the pork.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
And sort of incremental differences. Okay. So as they do, you get all these cracks and you're getting leaks of information. And the more it leaks, the more the general population is letting go of the official reality and starting to deal with reality.
Yes,
and I see
absolutely.
That as potentially very positive because, for example, so one takeaway I would take from what I'm seeing is that I think the deep state has decided that about 40% of the establishment is now superfluous and can be re-engineered out.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking to downsize. That's number one. And as they do, all those people are beginning to realize that they're about to be ejected. And what you're watching are people who've lived in the unipolar bubble who are very comfortable. Mm-hmm. And they're now contemplating the fact that they're no longer needed to put a pretty face to things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also very much agree with this idea of cracks where light comes through. For instance, the Occupy Wall Street movement, its big success is the concept of one percenter. I think it's huge that
right.
this finally came out in the open. And I think I see Sanders a concession to the Sanders is a safety valve for the Occupy Wall Street movement, just as Trump is an attempt to cater to the Tea Party. And Ron Paul, for instance, was never, elected president. He achieved a lot of visibility by just raising the topics, which in the past were not part of the official
right.
discourse. So there is a gradual, the state is failing, the deep state is failing in its ideological control over the United States, and there definitely is frustration. A lot of people, it's, personal anecdote, but I think most people hate both parties
and
there is a sense of alienation, I think, very much so. And that is exactly what was observed in, most Russians will tell you, who lived through that, the U.S. today looks very much like the Brezhnev and the last years of the Soviet Union in the 80s. Very, very similar kind of, people don't have an ability to change the regime, but they're disgusted and they say it openly. and they make jokes about it, and they officially show disrespect and you know, disgust for the regime. And I see that all over the place here.
Well, I think the United States has the problem that they're neither feared nor respected. And you know, we've gone from a world where we were respected and feared to one where yes. we're not respected and we're not feared.
It's absolutely and true.
Part of the problem is you have to make a switch. If you have to make a switch from the unipolar to a multipolar world, and you have to do it, then you need leadership who can do it. But we don't have, I mean, what we're holding up and running around and promoting in this presidential election is people who can't do it.
Yes, so, absolutely true.
You know, it's, right, it's the unipolar team. The unipolar team is fighting over who gets to be bad at multipolar, is what it looks like to me.
So, yes, it's absolutely true. And the pork, as you say, yes.
The Sorry, Hello? I didn't understand.
The pork, yeah, you said the pork. Can you hear me?
The pork.
Is the connection okay?
Yeah, no, I didn't understand. The pork?
The pork, you said. Who gets the money?
Oh, the pork. Who gets the money?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you said pork with a T, not pork with a K.
No, sorry. It's a cell phone here.
Okay, so one other thing I wanted to bring up. I just wrote a commentary called The Kingsman Campaign. Have you seen the movie The Kingsman yet?
No, I haven't.
I recommend it to you highly, even though it's a dreadful movie.
Okay.
I think it's number 6 or number 7 on Netflix, but in the movie, there's a Silicon a billionaire called Richmond Valentine, who is played by Samuel Jackson, and he has given out free SIM cards, which connect people to his cell network. He's fielded a global array of satellites, and he's built a machinery that can literally, you know, according to the tones, he basically can influence or control their behavior, including making them jump up and kill each other. So
okay.
I'm going to turn them very violent. Anyway, so I did a survey of the campaign, and as Trump and Clinton were both emerging, and I sort of went to 20 people whose advice I go to and who I really value, and I said, okay, you know, how many people think that Richmond, what percentage of support for the two candidates is coming from Richmond Valentine? And so how much of it is coming from the entrainment, the media, the subliminal programming, all the different techniques you have to
right.
pump this? And they said 75 to 80%. And so when
Amazing.
People say to me, what's going to happen to Trump? I say, what does Richmond Valentine want to have happen to Trump?
Yeah,
That's
yes.
what's going to happen to Trump. Yeah, I had thought Trump was going to be was going to white out all the other Republican contenders so that Bush could take the Republican nomination. Now I think you're probably right. He's there to white out the Republicans for the Clinton. But, you know, I think the question ultimately is, what does Richmond Valentine want?
Well, there is always the possibility, which I would not discount completely, of, you know, the creature getting out of control.
Right.
That has happened in the past. And in theory, you know, a man with enough wealth and maybe if he surprised himself by, you know, entering that race just for some, you know, some back room deal with the deep state, and then he goes, you know, I'm electable, maybe he will begin believing in himself, and maybe if he gets to power, he will suddenly do things which were not expected. I mean, I'm not holding my breath, I'll be honest, but I don't
right.
completely discount that possibility. There is a small chance of that still happening. I mean, that's my very, very minimal hope.
Well, here's the thing. It seems to me that America's plan to go into a multipolar world is to kind of crash into it, and you just wonder how ugly it's going to be.
I think they're not accepting it yet. I don't think they have made their peace, and I don't think there's a plan to go in a multipolar world. They're resisting it. I mean, this pivot to Asia, this essentially war with Russia, because that's what's happening. I mean, the U.S. is at war, make no mistake about that, with Russia.
Right.
80% information, 15% economy, and 5%, you know, military in the Ukraine and Syria. But all this are clear signs that the U.S. is not accepting it yet.
Right.
They're fighting.
So tell us what happens next between the United States and Russia. Where does this go over the next year?
Well, that is an extremely hard thing to answer. I mean, it depends if we assume a rational actor on the part of the United States or not. So far, when it got to the brink, the U.S. has been rational, as, for instance, the example with Iran showed. So my hope is that there's part of the deep state, and I have to thank part of the military and probably intelligence community, who are sufficiently patriotic to avoid getting the planet into a nuclear war. I mean, I want to believe in that. Not the politicians, they're too stupid and arrogant. But if that is still the case, if there's enough non-neocons, you know, American patriots, who understand that this is the next strategic objective for this country, is to make a soft landing, as soft as can be. It's going to be a rough landing anyways. No empire has gently landed into a state of normalcy and become a normal country. But I think this is the big hope, is that there is a way to achieve as soft as landing as possible. If that is going to happen, then we're going to see more of the same, which is basically a gradual erosion of U.S. Power and influence, and the U.S. having to accept that it has to have limited international objectives and negotiations. The good sign is, as long as this, we see that happening, we're basically on a dangerous but possibly viable track. If we see, for instance, a Hillary presidency and the resurgence of that insane anti-Russian rhetoric and attempts to restart a war in Europe, then all bets are off. And I'm afraid that's the neocon plan. To have a war in Europe is the way for them to save their idea of what the United States, what I call the Anglo-Zionist Empire, is supposed to be.
And what does that war look like? Is it a land war or a nuclear war?
Well, Russia will... I think Russia would prevail even in conventional terms, actually, because I don't believe the Europeans... It's a farce there. NATO is a military farce right now. So I think it would remain a mostly political and conventional war. But if the United States got involved seriously, Russia would... Absolutely. And it's clearly, the Russian doctrine says, if the survival of Russia as a state is threatened, they reserve the right to use nuclear weapons first. So, and of course, if nuclear weapons are used against Russia, that's another situation where Russia would retaliate. So there would be a severe risk of nuclear war. Militarily speaking, using nukes in Europe makes no sense. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. But again, if we assume rational actors on the U.S. side, it's not going to happen. I always say the Russians are ready for war, but they fear war. They will do everything they can. That is the overriding and number one objective of Putin, is to avoid a nuclear war with the United States while participating to the evolution from a unipolar to a multipolar world. And the big risk is like a bomb that you have to defuse, is to make it happen in such a way that doesn't force the United States, doesn't corner the U.S. into a nuclear war with Russia and China, or China.
So the way you do this, and it's interesting to watch the developments, the challenge that Europe has is it's locked right now into the euro. The challenge the United States is it's dependent on the dollar. So if you are Mr. Global running this thing, the question is, how do you incrementally, you know, the dollar market share has been coming down. So it's a matter of building up all the other arrangements, which takes time. Mm-hmm. And that's what you've got to do. And we see the European central banks now working on their own version of Bitcoin. And, you know, so I think what you're going to see is massive efforts at building out the currencies and the payment system. So whatever the transition is, it doesn't hiccup and, you know, pull the whole world into nuclear war. Because that's what's going to force nuclear war, when they can't make the cash flows work and somebody gets cornered by the cash flows.
Yes, if they have nothing else to lose, absolutely.
Right. Okay, so you've been very generous with your time. And I want you to again describe your fabulous website and how we participate in the Sacred of the Vineyard world.
Well, you can go to the website is thesacre, in one word, .is. It's in Iceland, so thesacre is. And we put updates and guest articles, and all the information there is available, also for my newest book, The Essential Sacre. You can find it there.
So I just have to mention that I have finished your book, and it's absolutely fantastic. I told you, I printed out the whole thing before I realized how long it was.
Yeah.
So I had the paper sitting on my den, and every time I would stop and take a break or, you know, have dinner, I would just grab, you know, 20 or 30 pages and read. And mm-hmm. finally, the day came when I walked out for dinner. I'd finished it at lunch, and I realized there's nothing, I can't get my Saker fix. So you have to write another one, you know.
Anyway, well, I'll give you the exclusive information. I am working on a joint book with another author.
Oh, fabulous.
On an interesting topic, but I won't say any further than
okay,
I can't
don't say anything.
The author or the topic, but I'll promise you it's okay. Interesting. The other author is a very interesting man.
Okay, but your current one, everyone can buy by going to your website.
And on Amazon.
The name? Or Amazon.
It's called
okay,
The Essential Saker, and it's available also on Amazon.
Okay, and here's the thing I want to tell everyone. It weaves between the geopolitics and sort of some of the military issues with culture. And you go from the macro to the micro, and there are parts where you just feel free to let your feelings flow in reaction to something. I'm thinking of particularly of some of the French politics that had me lying on the den floor laughing and pounding the floor. They were so funny. But you literally laugh until you cry because we're dealing with a very inhuman force that's coming. And
yes.
You found a way to rant about the inhumanity of it, which I don't, you know, a lot of the ranting just gets me exhausted. But you have a way of ranting about it, which is really uplifting and rejuvenating. So I can't recommend it to you enough. I just would tell people, just be warned before you print it out. It's very long. You're getting lots for your money. Anyway, and
we can also
donate at your site, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
There's a donation button to support our work.
Okay, well, we're, you know, the Salier Report is here to support you. We can't thank you enough for your work. You make sense of it all, because whenever I go to your website, what happens is I find myself looking at something in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm shaking my head, and I say, I don't, you know, what is going on? And I say, I know, I'll go see what Saker has to say about this.
Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say so.
Okay, well, before we close, anything you want to add? What should we be looking for in the next, until we get to talk to you again in 3 months?
A possible resumption of hostilities in the Ukraine, unfortunately, is a very real risk because the infighting has started among the elites there. The country is completely ungovernable. It's actually breaking apart. The regional powers are becoming more important than even the central authorities. So there is a very real risk of a resumption of combat operations against the Donbas in the next couple of months.
Mm.
Sorry about that. Yeah. Pessimistic.
Yeah,
tone.
No. It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Saker, you have a wonderful quarter, and we'll talk to you in 3 months.
Okay. Thank you so much. Greetings to everybody, and thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.